This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, biologist Craig Venter joins us to talk about his latest synthetic life form, SYN 3.0. It's a bacterium with the smallest genome of any known self-replicating cell. Sounds exciting. We'll talk about that. But first, California. You know, it's still in the grips of its multi-year drought. Governor Jerry Brown signed an executive order that cut back water use by 25% in cities and towns. Restaurants only serve water upon request. Residents have been cutting down on shower times. So why, oh why, then, are reservoirs draining off their water? Here to tell us about these reservoir rules is Lauren Sommer. She's the science and environment reporter at KQED in San Francisco, which is where she joins us from today. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira.
Okay, so what's with the state dumping water from reservoirs?
Yeah, it sounds really bizarre, right? And the thing is, these reservoirs aren't even completely full. These are our biggest reservoirs. Obviously, we're paying attention to every single storm that comes in and dumps water into them. But some of them are only like 60% full, and they're having to release water and empty out. And it sounds really strange, right?
You betcha.
Well, there's a good reason for that. When big storms hit here in California, you get a lot of water flowing out of the mountains, and these reservoirs need to have space to catch it, right? If you are too full and a big storm comes, you kind of risk overtopping the dam or maybe flooding people downstream. So, you know, it's one of those things. The rule is there for safety reasons, but it feels weird to Californians who are having to conserve at home.
This is an old rule, right? Goes back 100 years or more?
Yep, and it's the way water is kind of managed across the West. It's kind of these very strict rules. But there are some folks and scientists here that are trying to change this, and they think it could be done better if you use weather forecasts, right? So instead of having these set rules about how empty you have to be, you could watch the weather forecast, and if a big storm comes through, you're about to see it on the horizon, you could empty out the reservoir safely, create some space just in case. But obviously the benefit is if the big storms don't come in, you wouldn't have released that water, and then maybe you would have it for later in the summer when you really need it.
This sounds too logical, Lauren, too.
Yeah, and you know, all of us know sometimes the weather forecasts are slightly off, right? And that's a big deal for this kind of study. You know, we have these big atmospheric river storms here in California. There's kind of like this big stream of moisture that barrels across the Pacific and slams into California. You know, we need a handful of these is actually most of our precipitation in a given year. But if you get it off just a little tiny bit, yeah, you know, this strategy doesn't quite work.
Yeah, so they're trying to be overly cautious, is what you're saying, because they know if they guess it wrong, it could be flooding and things like that. That could be a disaster.
Yeah, definitely.
So they're going to look into this a little more and see what happens.
Yeah, if it works at a couple reservoirs, they'll probably expand it, but it has to work in those first few case studies.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to another story you're working on that researchers have pinpointed why some people are big risk takers. Does that mean like people go gambling or...
Yeah, maybe I should ask you, Ira, if you walk into a Las Vegas casino, do you go straight to the high-stakes poker table or penny slots?
I do. I put my $5 down right on the high-stakes table.
So according to these researchers, it probably has to do with what's happening in one region of your brain. What they did is they set up an experiment with rats. And so there were these two levers that the rats could push. You know, one was a nice, steady snack. It was guaranteed. The other one would give them a really big snack, but it only happened every so often. It was a much riskier choice. And what they found is that the rats that were more conservative, that didn't like taking risks, what was happening in their brains is that when they had to make that decision, their brain was sending them a signal reminding them of the loss of the previous choice they made. You know, if they lost, there was a strong signal in one part of their brain. You know, it involved dopamine, which is this neurochemical that's important to emotion and thinking. And it was reminding them, hey, that was pretty bad last time. You better play it safe. But in the rats that really liked taking risks, they didn't really get that signal as strong. Their brain wasn't reminding them how painful it was last time, and they would just keep going back to that risky behavior. And so what the researchers did is they actually used the light to manipulate the brain cells in this in these rats that like taking risks, and they amped up that signal of the loss of the pain, and they could make these rats that like taking risks be more conservative just by altering this one signal.
Wow. So that's not something they're going to put in the drinks at the casinos anytime soon, I don't think.
It would be bad for business, I'm guessing. But what's interesting is we know that there's actually medications that can kind of, we think, interfere with this already. You know, there's a drug called Mirapex, which is prescribed for some folks with Parkinson's or restless leg syndrome. And there are people that are on that drug that some of them actually develop gambling problems because they think it's interfering with this part of the brain.
That's very interesting. That is the serious part. Now, I understand there's a killer out on the loose on the prairies.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a dark story. Just to warn you, it's going to maybe alter your image of a very cute mammal. So are you prepared for this, hopefully?
Of course.
So these researchers were studying white-tailed prairie dogs in western Colorado. And what they were noticing is that some of these prairie dogs seem to have serial killer tendencies. They saw these adult prairie dogs running over, grabbing baby ground squirrels, which is a different species, and killing them and leaving their bodies behind. You know, run over, grab them, shake them, kill them, and leave them. And this was a big surprise. You know, certainly they weren't expecting to see that, you know, without maybe them eating them or some other big benefit. But their hypothesis is just that these species, they eat some of the same grasses and plants. They're herbivores. And so they found that, you know, some of these mother white-tailed prairie dogs, when they were killing lots of baby ground squirrels, it actually increased the likelihood that their own families would be successful. So maybe they're reducing the competition for a food source. That's kind of the thought that these researchers have.
Well, are they the only animals that do this kind of thing? Do we know of others?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that surprising in the carnivore world, right? Like, you can kind of picture that those animals are kind of fighting for territory or for food resources. But it was really surprising for these researchers to see it in herbivores and, you know, not something you expect of a little mammal.
Yeah. Let's talk about finally what is this burnt hot dog of the sea that you have uncovered?
Yeah, these are sea cucumbers. You could think of them as maybe an animal that does not get a lot of respect, right? They're kind of these blobs. Yeah. They move along the seafloor very slowly, not really charismatic. And this particular one really does look like a burnt hot dog. It's kind of like a charred sausage color. But a group of researchers was studying them off of the coast of Japan to figure out, you know, how are these species doing? Is there enough genetic diversity? Because there's actually a lot of fishing pressure on sea cucumbers. In some Asian countries, they're eaten or they're dried for medicinal purposes. And they were finding that there was kind of alarmingly low levels of genetic diversity in this one population. And, you know, they're kind of raising the warning flag that, you know, hey, you may not think they're very cute, but sea cucumbers are actually really important to the marine ecosystem. They're basically garbage men of the sea. They clean up all the detritus on the floor. So very important.
Very important. And then important stuff you always bring us, Lauren. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
Wishing you more rain. Lauren Sommer is the science environment reporter at KQED in San Francisco. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. It's becoming a regular story. Warming temperatures, rising sea levels, shifting habitats. But how does that translate to your wine glass? Yeah, you like wine? Joining me now to talk about the good and bad of climate change as it relates to wine is Elizabeth Wolkovich. She's an assistant professor of organismic and evolutionary biology based at Harvard University's Arnold Arboretum in Boston. And she's co-author of a paper out this week in the journal Nature Climate Change, looking at wine territories. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Now, nice to be here.
You're welcome. The climate is shifting, making wine regions in France. They're being affected also?
Yes. So we looked at whether you can use the timing of the harvest dates of wine grapes going all the way back to the 1600s and see a couple things. One, how is the timing of wine grape harvest changing? We also looked at some correlations with wine quality. And then we were fundamentally interested in using the records to ask how the climate system itself has shifted.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you discover? There are longer periods of warm weather without being in drought, and that affects the wine?
Well, yes. Yeah. So really, the wine grapes are a sentinel for us to better understand the climate system in this paper. So what we found using these long-term records, so these are all across France, from Loire Valley, from Burgundy, from Bordeaux, we collected, our colleagues collected these incredible records going back to the 1300s, actually. We put them together, and we said, what's changed in what actually drives the timing of an early or late harvest? Mm-hmm. And what we saw was that before 1980, a hot summer was usually an early harvest, and a hot summer was also a dry summer. And that makes sense from a climate perspective. So to get a really hot summer back then, you needed dry soils to feed back with the air and warm it up and get, you know, really high temperatures in the 90s or 100s. But what we see since 1980 in these harvest records is that a hot summer no longer has to be a dry summer. It could be a slightly wet summer, a humid summer. And all that's driving the timing across France of wine grape harvest is just a hot summer. And hot summer is no longer a dry summer, is this fundamental shift that we found.
But isn't that a good thing?
It's not necessarily a good thing. It depends on who you're what you're talking about. So it's maybe a good thing right now for wine quality, because high quality wines usually come from earlier harvests. Earlier harvests come from hotter summers, so we do get higher quality wines in the last 30 to 40 years, and that's correlated with climate change. That won't last forever. And I think it's a really bad thing because, you know, if you've ever spent a 90-degree day in a desert in California or a 90-degree day in, you know, the summer in Georgia, you know that a humid heat is a lot harder on people than a hot, dry heat. So we are expecting in Europe in the future, if we keep warming up the globe, that we will get more of these hot, humid summers, and those are actually really dangerous for people.
And as far as changing the wine growing regions, will climate change change where the grapes are growing?
I think about that a lot. So there's lots of projections that people have published over the last 10 years showing, you know, the great new wine growing regions of England and further north in Europe, where we haven't really seen wine grapes for a very long time, or perhaps forever, even though we have, you know, 1,000 years of records of where wine grapes have been grown. But I actually think there's a lot of room for adaptation, because wine grapes are, they're actually incredibly climatically diverse. We have certain varieties like Riesling. We grow Riesling where it's cold. We grow Pinot Noir where it's fairly cool. We grow Cabernet Sauvignon and Italian and Sicilian varieties where it's really hot. So we change our varieties. I don't think we have to change where we grow wine grapes.
Elizabeth Wolkovich, Assistant Professor of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology at Harvard. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. When we come back, Craig Venter is here to talk about synthetic DNA and Life 3.0 after this break. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You've probably heard of minimal art, minimal music, minimalist design and architecture. How about minimalist biology? If such a thing exists, then my next guest, Dr. Craig Venter, is at the avant-garde. You may remember a few years ago, he and his team synthesized a complete genome from scratch and booted up a bacterial cell with it. Now they've taken a second look at the synthetic genome, snipping and slicing it down to the very bare minimum number of genes needed to bring a cell to life. How many is that? I'm not going to spoil the surprise. Let's have Dr. Venter here tell us himself. Craig Venter is a biologist and a founder and CEO of the J. Craig Venter Institute in La Jolla. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's so nice to be with you again.
Thank you. So what's the answer? How many genes really are essential for life in your study?
So essential is a context-specific question. So The number would not be an essential number for humans or even an essential number for surviving in the wild, but surviving in our laboratory conditions with well-grown things, the number comes out at only 473 genes.
Wow.
But I think the biggest surprise is 149 of those are of complete unknown function. And this is a very different view of life than we've had for the last 20 years.
Wow, so we really don't know why it needs 149 of those genes or what those genes are doing, but it won't survive without that.
That's right. So we know they're essential for life in this minimal organism and its growth conditions, but it's interesting. So in 1995, my team sequenced the first two genomes in history, and we and everybody else compared those two to each other, and these studies have been ongoing for the last 20 years, and people decided the number of minimal genes was somewhere between 256 and like 320 or so. And we even started to believe that ourselves, and we set out to design a cell from scratch in the computer, assuming this community knowledge of biology was actually necessary and sufficient to define life. And we designed a cell with, it was a little bit more than 256 genes. And we had a contest, and we had four or five different designs. We tried them all, and they all failed. So wow. Life by design, pure first principle design, did not work. And so what we had to do, we knew that when 5 years ago when we built our SYN 1.0 genome, that we had constructed all those genes correctly because we had this living cell. So we took sets of genes from SYN 1.0 and then added it back to our design set, and we kept adding back until we could get a living cell. And we called that 2.0, and then we worked to work out which one of those were really not necessary. And it's not so easy as just pulling one out and testing it. So if you were new to this planet and you were looking at a 777 and you were trying to work out its function by pulling parts off.
You mean the airplane, the 737?
Yes, and you found these pod-like things hanging off the wings, and you remove the one from the right wing, you would find that the airplane could still fly and land. So you'd say, obviously, that part is not necessary for airplane flight. And so if you then applied that rule, and you say, well, there's one on the other wing as well, we can obviously dispense with that. And you throw that out, and all of a sudden the airplane crashes. So that's what happens in biology, is we have pairs or more than pairs of things that either have similar functions or coexistent functions that you have to have both parts there. And it turns out 32% of these parts are unknown. So we're truly like the aliens from another planet trying to examine the airplane and work out what its parts do.
Is this frustrating to know that you don't know what those 149 genes do?
Well, it's frustrating, but it's also enlightening because the scientific community has been basically suffering from the delusion that we did know all of the biology. And so the fact that we've been missing a third or so it's exciting because we can now move and try to understand those. You know, you've been covering science for forever, and so, you know, it's one of the ironies of science is you can only study the known world. Our entire view is based on what we know currently as reality. Well, it turns out we were missing about a third of reality in terms of biology. So that's probably the most important finding, and it's frustrating, it's humbling, it's exciting. It's all the above.
Tell me what the point from just purely, hey, how, you know, like Lincoln Logs or Legos putting together the minimum amount of genes you need for a living organism. What could, you know, what use would you make out of this now that you can do this?
Well, proving that we can do it, and this is the first time somebody, to my knowledge, has attempted to actually design a species in the computer and then bring it to life. It tells us about fundamentals of biology. We probably never would have discovered this third of of essential genes without this experiment. And so really trying to get down to the essence of life, to define it in this complex genomic software fashion tells us maybe more about how they came together. It certainly tells us that we need to look at life in a genome-centric view versus what's been done for a long time of a gene-centric view. We can't just look at a function of a gene. We have to look at it in the context of a whole. It's sort of like an orchestra You can take out one violin or one piccolo and not substantially change things. But our cells work together in an orchestrated function of having all the components working together. So I think it really helps us understand life. It also helps us with the next stage. If we're really going to do life by design for an industrial revolution of changing manufacturing from agricultural processes to truly cellular manufacturing, example for food, we need to really know what all the components do and then how to add new components to get where we want to go. So getting to a baseline chassis is sort of an intellectual point there. If we now add components to it that we understand, we should be able to understand, huge steps in evolution. Yeah, we should be able to cover a billion years of evolution in a year or so, getting to these next stages.
So do you have a plan? How do you tease out then what these other the genes that aren't doing anything? I think we used to call it junk DNA back in the day. Do you have a plan to figure out what these genes do? I mean, is there a way to find out why you need them?
Well, it is a great question, and it's also an irony of science that we only study the known world. It's probably impossible to get a grant from the U.S. government to study genes of unknown function, even if they're essential for life, because it's hard to put a grant together when you don't know what they do. So what we're hoping will happen, number one, we're funding a lot of internal grants at the Venter Institute to try and see if we can decipher some of those, and we're making some headway. So for looking at the gene structure, we can tell, for example, that a protein would be a transmembrane protein and have all the structural lookalikes of being a transporter of some substance. Hmm. What we don't know is what does it actually transport and why is what it transports essential for life of the cell. Yeah. So knowing the transporter, then you can design experiments, sort of a trial and error things by eliminating things from the media or just other mechanisms to see what that transports. Mm-hmm. Those are probably going to be the easier ones to do. The ones that are going to be tougher, where the structures don't look like anything we've seen before, so there's no hints from a structural association. And we don't know what they do because we assumed we already had all the essential components in the cell. So maybe they do subtle things of modifying protein manufacturing or chromosome replication or something. So it's going to take more effort. But what we hope happens, because there's so much research going on globally, it's highly likely in some lab somewhere around the world, somebody is studying these proteins and all of a sudden they're going to find when they get to the gene that we can make a link by homology to one of the things we're discovering. So we hope to excite the world scientific community to take on this challenge of this understanding this important gene set, because there has to be very exciting new universal biology, because I'd say over half of these genes are highly conserved throughout evolution.
Yeah,
I guess they won't tell us just about our minimal cell. They'll tell us something about all of life.
Yeah, well, if they weren't important, why wouldn't they, be conserved? And since you came out with your first synthetic life, the gene editing technique called CRISPR has really exploded. How does CRISPR fit in? How is it similar and different than what you're doing? Does it eliminate the need to build entire genomes from scratch, so to speak, as you're doing?
Yeah. So CRISPRs are a fantastic editing tool, and we use them all the time in the lab, and synthetic genomics is using them all the time. I think we have this project at SGI with where we're trying to edit the pig genome to allow organ transplantation, such as hearts and lungs and livers, between pigs and humans by changing the pig genes to human genes, so they're not rejected. So in some cases, there's minor differences between the pig sequence and the human sequence. We use CRISPRs for making those edits, and it's really fantastic how easy that is to do now. I think it's one of the most wonderful discoveries in recent science. But other areas, we're writing entirely new code to put in, so we're using both approaches. So think of the difference between editing and writing something new. So you could take our science paper and certainly edited it. And in fact, that's what the editors at Science did. They did a lot of editing on it. But there's no way by editing that manuscript you would turn that into an exciting book about philosophy.
It's that different is what you're saying.
Yeah. Editing is editing versus de novo creation.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why we value creation so much in works of art, literature, science writing, etc. Many people make their living by doing editing, which is very different than de novo creation.
Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Craig Venter, founder and CEO of the J. Craig Venter Institute in La Jolla. You know, the first thing people are going to want to know, I probably don't have to ask you, you've been asked to press conferences and things like that. What someday could you design a minimal human genome?
It's an interesting question. Yeah. In fact, somebody recently, I don't know where the paper was, I just saw the headlines, claimed that they had a set of 3,000 minimal essential human genes. Mm-hmm. And I kind of laughed at myself because it's sort of starting where we were 20 years ago with the minimal bacterial cell and missing most of the metaphors, for example, looking at the airplane. But, you know, all definitions of genomes have to be in context. If we would want those humans to be highly adaptable to live in all the different environments that we live in, have intellectual adaptation, et cetera, I doubt that we will ever want to do that, even hypothetically. Can people live without some genes? Yes, but that's what we're finding at my main enterprise now, Human Longevity, where we've thus far sequenced 25,000 human genomes, we find that people can live without certain genes, but in many cases, just mutating those genes causes unusual traits and or disease. So more genes, you know, when you look at E. coli has almost 5,000-something genes versus the 400 in this minimal set, but E. coli can survive in lots of different environments, do all kinds of complex metabolism.
Yeah.
It can manufacture its own amino acids versus we provide all these to this minimal cell. So life is very much contextual, and our software for life has to be defined in terms of that context.
Well, I only have about a minute left, Dr. Venter. What's the next step here for you in this project?
Well, there's two different directions. So the next steps are, as we talked about, trying to define what these new unknown genes are and why they're so essential for life. On the other hand, we've developed an incredible set of tools. We had to make thousands and thousands of synthetic constructs to do this trial and error thing to find these 149 genes. And now writing the genetic code is 10 times faster than it was 5 years ago when we made the first synthetic cell. In fact, synthetic genomics sells a robot for automatically assembling DNA. So the field is moving very fast to enable other people to have tools for writing DNA and doing all kinds of new constructs that we can try and get cells to take over manufacturing of pharmaceuticals, food, chemicals, even construction materials for Mars.
Wow. Sounds exciting. We'll have to have you back, Dr. Venter, to talk more about
this. All right. It's always nice talking with you. Thank you for having me on.
Craig Venter is a biologist and founder and CEO of the J. Craig Venter Institute in La Jolla. Coming up, we get the backstory on a 50-year quest to record black holes colliding. It's the history of LIGO. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Last month, the science world was transfixed by a chirp. Remember that? That little sound represents a big astronomical event. Two black holes slamming into one another 1.3 billion years ago. And the crash was so cataclysmic, it rippled the fabric of space-time, and it sent scientists at LIGO the signal that they had been waiting for 50 years, the very first direct evidence of gravity waves. So why did it take so long to get that sound? By the numbers, as I say, it took over 50 years, $1 billion, over 1,000 scientists. But my next guest will tell you that ain't the half of it. Jenna Levin is a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College here in New York. Her new book, Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space, tells the story of LIGO, one of the biggest physics experiments ever attempted. It is a tale of clashing egos, false starts, big machines, and teeny tiny signals. She joins me here in our New York studios to talk about it. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Sarah. Always good to be here.
You know, it's sort of the book is like, it's entitled Black Holes Blues, but it's really about gravity waves.
Yeah, well, the title was really inspired by one of the original architects, Ray Weiss. He said to me in August, just before this first detection was made, if we don't detect black holes, the whole thing is a failure. This is after he's devoted 50 years to the experiment. And I thought that was such a bold statement to say that before the experiment had succeeded. So I thought about this black hole blues as, you know, being this long campaign and they still hadn't succeeded, at least at that time.
But you were there at the right time last fall. Was that an accident? Tell us what happened.
Well, so what happened is I was 2 years late on a book. And I set out to write a very different book. I wanted to write a book about black holes, which I know very well. That's my bread and butter scientific research. And so I thought, oh, it'll be a breeze. I'll write it overnight. But instead, I got caught up in this LIGO story, which is an experiment that was really beyond my skill set. I mean, I don't build things. I just do pen and paper and imagine.
You're a theorist.
I am a sad little theorist.
You never get your hands dirty.
No. Yeah. I mean, Ray once let me do an experiment with him, but it was kind of like how you might let a child, you know? And I just became completely enamored of the ambition and the insanity of it.
And so but they made the discovery while you were finishing up the book.
Right. So I was hanging out a lot at the sites and hanging out with the experimentalists a lot. And so when they had installed the advanced components of this machine and they were ready to start taking data, I sort of figured time to wrap up. And funnily enough, on the day that the detection was made, I printed a draft for Kip Thorne and Ray Weiss, two of the original architects. So they didn't tell me, though, right away. They let me sit in.
Did they give you a hint at all? Don't publish it right now. It's something big is going to happen.
Ray was sort of like, you know, what are you going to do if there's a discovery? But they did take pity on me and tell me early, as soon as they were sure, which was very, very kind of them.
How much of this was luck that they heard it at that point?
Well, a lot of the experimentalists told me 2018. A lot. I would say everybody told me 2018 will be the first detections.
Really?
So they knew that the advanced machine was doing well, but I don't think they anticipated. It's really not at its full capability. I think they expected to have to spend a couple of years beating the instrument down and making it more sensitive. Instead, during an engineering run, they weren't even doing science runs. They were still hammering at the machine, interrupting the data. People were there till the wee hours of the morning, the morning that the signal hit from 1.3 billion years ago, and they were interrupting machines. Luckily, everyone puts down their tools, decides they're too tired, and goes home.
Yeah. Well, you were almost, I'm reading the book, I'm saying, you're like a prophet. You predict almost exactly, and you didn't know this because it hadn't happened yet, exactly what was going to happen. And I have a little passage I'm going to ask you to read where you imagine the kind of signals LIGO might detect. Please, if you will.
Thank you. Okay, so this is somewhere midway through the book. There must be black holes out there that we can never see. They are alone, or they orbit another black hole. Nothing falls into them. Nothing shines bright enough, close enough. We cannot make out the shadow, at least not yet. But if the black holes collide, we might hear them ring space and time, sending waves in the curves of space-time through the universe traveling at the speed of light. If the gravitational observatories succeed, and we just marginally make out the reverberations against the noise, we can record the sounds of stars exploding in their final seconds before collapse. We can record the sound of imperfections scraping space-time as neutron stars spin. We can record the sounds of neutron stars colliding, possibly forming black holes. And we can record the sounds of black holes colliding to form heavier, silent black holes, emitting a billion, trillion, trillion, trillion watts of power in gravitational waves. And I should say that those aren't my predictions. Kip Thorne has been predicting the signals since the late 70s, and the entire theoretical scientific community threw themselves, not the entire community, but those interested in gravitational waves, at predicting these sounds.
And you actually expose the dark side of science research that people never get to see. Dark literally in crawling through tunnels, spiders and rats, and also the clashing egos and personalities of the scientists.
Yeah. It is a climbing Mount Everest story. There are bodies left along the side of the road. It's not all the glory of the announcement. It was a hard campaign, and it did literally take 50 years, and there were times when the experiment was really under threat of not actually being built and succeeding. So I didn't want to tell that story, though. I had to tell you the truth. I think that's why the book was 2 years late. I dreaded getting into all of that, and I just had to admit that was a story I was really writing.
And it is, but it's fascinating. It's because we don't really think about science. I mean, I don't think my audience, we're a little more fluent in science. But we don't really talk about much about the personalities, that there are real personalities involved. You think, musicians, they're a little this way, and artists are a little this way. Scientists are the same way.
Yeah, the experiment would not have been built if it were not for the individuals involved. It just wouldn't have been accomplished.
Let's talk about the difference. So your main characters are Ray Weiss, Kip Thorne, and Ron Drever. Tell us about their three different personalities.
Well, Ray, I spent a lot of time with, recorded a lot of tape, and it was actually talking to Ray that convinced me the book could kind of have this character-driven tone. Ray's just this amazing, direct, straight-talking kind of guy. He's a no-nonsense kind of scientist, and he just tells the truth. I remember there were parts of the book that he didn't necessarily want to read, but he was like, all right, it's true, you can keep it. You know, there was no sense of rewriting the past. A very straight-talking guy. So Ray has this beautiful line where he says to me, I started life with one ambition. I wanted to make music easier to hear. And he describes building these circuits to make music easier to hear. And then, you know, much later, he becomes obsessed with this idea. He could record the sounds of space-time ringing, and that the instrument he's thinking about, or at least LIGO does now, it spans the same frequency range as the piano, actually. It's actually in the human auditory range. So Ray fulfills this ambition in some kind of cosmic and glorious way by pushing through this instrument. And I should say he still works on the instrument. He's still on the ground in the tunnels, performing experiments.
And Kip Thorne is one of the original thinkers on this project.
Yeah, Kip is a very special person. I remember being very influenced by Kip when I was a young student and hearing him speak. He's a real dreamer, and his work can be very speculative, but it's also extremely formal and mathematical and precise. And that combination, I think, made him very special. He was famous at 30, professor at Caltech, and I talked to him about this a lot. I feel like Kip was looking for something bigger than just his own accomplishments. And when Ray and Kip sort of pooled their resources and banded together, that was when they could really realize bringing an experiment this big to Caltech. But that was Kip's initiative to bring an experimental ambition to detect gravity and gravitational waves to Caltech.
But one of his great talents also is his ability to soothe the egos, the competing egos, and keep people happy.
Kip is totally unflappable. And he's really a very charming person. I mean, everybody loves Kip. I had one part in the book that didn't make it through the edits, but there's a point where I'm sitting at Caltech during a sabbatical, and Kip's coming by, and people come to visit me, and I say, I'm waiting for Kip. And everyone goes, oh, Kip, okay, Kip. He's sort of a legend.
Yeah, he used to have a ponytail, if I remember, years ago.
But, he's
been around for a while.
He's a free spirit.
Yeah. And Ron Drever, the third part of the Troika.
So when Kip decides, Ray has already built this little prototype, which is maybe 3,000 times smaller than the actual machine. In the late 70s, he's built this at MIT, but it's a tiny little thing. It can't really compete with a real instrument, which hasn't been built. And Kip wants to bring this to Caltech. Mm-hmm. And he decides, and Caltech decides, to hire Ron Drever, who's a Scottish physicist, who is very ingenious, very clever, considered a very imaginative person. And I think Ray was second on the short list for this position. So they hire Ron Drever. Ron comes in the early 80s to Caltech, and he's visionary. He thinks in pictures, not in calculations. And he really does impress people that he can kind of see a solution when other people are taking days to do calculations. But he's also kind of impossible and doesn't want to collaborate and wants to push this through on his own. And the three are sort of forced to form a coalition, which is nicknamed the Troika. Mm-hmm. And it's a good and important alliance, but as Ray says, we couldn't make one decision as a group.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you can't do any of this huge project without the money.
Right.
And that was a mm-hmm. large part. Again, getting the National Science Foundation involved and Congress.
Right.
Had to be convinced of spending this money on something.
Yes.
That, you know.
So eventually directors do come in, Robbie Vogt, after him Barry Barish, and they're crucial in securing the money. And it starts with a couple $100 million, a few $100 million, but that's really just R&D. Yeah. And it's not until 2000, so this is from the late 60s to 2000, before the first generation of instruments are actually built.
Mm-hmm. One of the characters in your book that you spent quite a while talking about is a sort of a tragic figure, Joe Weber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he created his first little detector and was not, included in the final team.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
So I think Joe is a tragic figure, and I think he deserves credit now for starting the field. And even before Ray and Kip and Ron Drever, there was Joe Weber, and he sort of struck out alone. People at this time, you have to realize, still didn't believe black holes were real. So now this is the early 60s, and people weren't even sure gravitational waves were real. This was hotly contested. And Joe goes out and he builds what's called a Weber bar. It's kind of like a tuning fork. If it's struck by a gravitational wave, if space and time is rippling, it will ring at a particular frequency. And after about 10 years of doing this, more or less on his own, he makes an announcement that he has evidence for gravitational waves. He becomes the most famous scientist.
Celebrated.
He's on the covers of magazines. Before you know it, there are Weber bars everywhere, all over the world. And there's even not a Weber bar, but one of his machines is put on the moon. And he's enormously famous. But then in 2 years' time, all of these other detectors return silence. They hear nothing from the universe. They don't detect anything. And there's also a concern that the rate at which his bars are ringing would suggest that the entire galaxy is just consuming itself and would disrupt entirely. So it doesn't really seem to be hanging together. But Joe spends the next 30 years insisting.
Let me just, while we have a little break here, I'm talking with Jan Levin, author of the terrific book, Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And so he sort of becomes disgraced.
Yes,
right?
It's very painful.
They make fun of him.
Yeah.
They get up at meetings and
try to trick him.
They
try to trick him some people do, with false claims that he corroborates, and then it's revealed that it was a false claim. It's a terrible story. All his funding is withdrawn. He eventually supports his own observatory, he says, with his wallet, and he'll kind of show his wallet for proof.
Yeah.
Now Joe's going to come back around, I'm sure of it, in terms of in people's minds. And if you read the LIGO paper that made the big announcement, they discuss Joe in the opening pages, which I really respect.
Is the Troika going to win the Nobel Prize?
I hope so. I'm going to get into a lot of trouble. I've already gotten into trouble.
Is it bad luck?
Not
to
up to me, man, to say who gets the Nobel Prize.
Phone's
going to
ring at 3 in the morning. And
yeah.
A little...
I'd be very happy with the Troika. Maybe not everyone feels that
you
way.
Write so enthusiastically in this book.
Like, thank you. You're
there, and you also insert yourself into the narrative. And you refer to everybody in their first name.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that's the level you had to know them? They're all on first name basis?
Yeah, it's interesting. I know Kip very well. Kip is a friend, and I got to know Ray very well. And so I know everybody in the book on a first name basis. It seemed awkward to falsely formalize it. And I did go back and forth, though. I don't know Ron personally.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron's health isn't good. And Ron Drever. And so for a while, I did refer to him as Drever, actually. But Kip called me on it. He said he should be Ron, too. I thought, that's right. There's a certain intimacy. And I got to know his brother in communications.
Yeah.
And I think it lends a certain intimacy, just the fact that I'm on the ground and a scientist involved with them. It's both the reason I didn't want to write about them. But
that's the reason you got welcomed
that's
in.
That's right.
Because
that's
right. You're a theoretical physicist.
Yes, that's right.
We're going to have you come back and talk about black holes, which I know is, you know, your specialty, because there's so much there. And we love to talk about them, and we want to know where everything goes once it goes into the black hole. Is the whole universe going to get sucked in? What's going to happen to it?
I hope you don't think I have the answer to that.
Well,
I'll speculate.
But that's the thing. No one knows.
That's right.
Right?
I mean, good speculation.
All right. It's a great book. It's called Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space. Jana Levin is the author, and it's coming out right now, right?
Tuesday.
Officially.
Officially
Tuesday. Well, we're glad we could have you on in advance. It's great, great read.
Thank you so much.
Jana Levin is the professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard, and she's, as I say, author of Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space. And we have an excerpt on our website that's at sciencefriday.com/blackholes. For all you trivia geeks here in New York City, and you know whom you are, we're hosting our second annual trivia night. Yes, come and be part of the fun and festivities. It's called Dangerous. It's going to get dangerous at 8 p.m. on Wednesday, May 18th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. We'll be playing 4 rounds of public trivia, all themed around dangerous science. It's going to be prizes, drinks, a live band. I'll be there. I know. The door prize. I hope you'll see all of that. So reserve a spot for your team. Bring your team early. Head over to sciencefriday.com/trivia for more info and to reserve your tickets. Charles Berkowitz is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, and Manny Minoff are our producers. Luke Raskin, our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And this weekend, you might be thinking a lot about eggs. Well, we've got a spotlight for you, eggheads. It's full of science. Egg science, including, yes, how to make the perfect hard-cooked egg. Yeah, not the green yolk. It's at sciencefriday.com/eggscience. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.